This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast for March 1st. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Today we've got a couple of exciting topics to talk about. We're going to talk about China and its oil demand going forward and its progression from an industrializing nation into a more of a mature economy and what the implications of that are on oil demand.
And we're going to finish off with some highlights from the closely followed annual BP Energy Outlook released a few weeks ago. And they had some interesting scenarios we wanted to look at. One was a ban on combustion vehicles in big parts of the world and what that would do for oil demand. And also, the first time I've seen this, a scenario about what the effect would be if we banned one-use plastics, which is a topic that's really gained a lot of momentum over the last
year. Increasing momentum, an important topic to consider.
Okay, so let's talk about China.
Let's do that. Yeah, well, I've been following China for a long time in terms of the energy demand. It's really interesting, almost from an energy transition laboratory, because it wasn't long ago in the 1980s that China was still largely an agrarian-based economy, very rural, and the population was growing. And the growth in energy demand was not, you know, all that significant, because agrarian economies don't necessarily have a big pull on energy consumption. But the reforms that were introduced by Deng Xiaoping in the 1980s leading into the 1990s really started to lay the seeds for China industrializing. And the minute that a country goes from an agrarian economy into industrialization mode, then you get a gigantic pull on energy consumption. And you get that gigantic pull on energy consumption because of the wealth creation effect, the creation of the middle class, where people migrate from rural economies into urban economies. They buy a refrigerator, they buy a scooter, eventually they buy a car, they get wealthier, and their energy consumption goes up manyfold. And really, that was the pull of China in the 2000s. And so when we see an industrializing economy, we also see energy transitions. What happens in the early days of a transition is that countries are still, as I said, agrarian. They rely largely on things like water power and rudimentary burning of wood and so on. But once they get into electrification, that's when things start to change. And electrification, typically in industrializing economies of that age, was based on coal. And so you start making a big pull on coal. It drives your machinery, it drives your economy, but then you realize you're making a big mess environmentally. You can't breathe, you're polluting your waterways, and then you have to switch to other modes of energy consumption. Also, the wealth creation leads into people buying vehicles, which gets you into the petroleum age, leading into buying cook stoves, which gets you into the natural gas age and furnaces and all those kind of things. And so what we've seen over the course of the last 20, 30 years is almost a laboratory of transition in action in a country like China in such huge dimension, because it has, what is it, Jackie, like 1.4 billion people
world.
Yeah. It's just huge. 1.4 billion people going through an energy transition, an economic transition in a very short period of time. But what happens is toward maturity, once you go through that, quote, developing nation status, and I think we can agree that China has fully developed into a mature economy now, is that things start to change again. Your GDP, whereas it used to be like 10% plus per year, growing compounding every year, now is starting to slow down. What are we at now? 6%? We're going to talk about that.
Yeah, they were 6.6% in 2018, and the outlook now is for 6.2%. And of course, that could go down further. There's real concerns about this trade war with the U.S. and how that may affect the Chinese economy.
So we want to talk about that. We want to talk about, okay, so now we have China as still actually largely powered by coal, but diversifying into renewables, more
60%
natural. 60%
coal.
60% coal still, but trying to diversify into renewables, but also quite a bit of natural gas. So what does this portend for the future if A, China starts to electrify more, go more into renewables, and B, what if the economy as a whole starts to slow? Because of course, energy consumption and economic activity are closely torqued together. And the torque starts to ease as you get into more of a mature phase away from that industrialization phase. So what does that mean for particularly oil demand? We're going to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, and it's so important. I call it the rule of one third when it comes to China. Mm-hmm. No matter where you look, China is one third. It's one third of all energy demand growth globally. It's one third of all oil demand growth globally. and it's 1/3 of all natural gas demand growth. So you just got to remember, you know, everything's a third. And if we start to see things change in China, it is consequential.
Yeah, I mean, let's take a third of oil demand growth. I mean, we're growing at what, 1.1, 1.2 million barrels per day per year?
I mean, this year, the expectation is a little higher, 1.3 is the goal.
So a third of that is China. So what, right. 400 or 500,000 barrels a day is China?
Yeah, between about 450,000 barrels a day is expected to come from China this year. And so if their economy slows or electric cars take off, there's some more reason to worry about that. So that's why it's worth talking about, because it is quite consequential to the outlook.
Sure. And we know that commodities like oil, natural gas, they're priced at the margin, particularly oil. In other words, small changes in oil consumption at the margin leads to volatile fluctuations in the price. And if the demand growth is curtailed, it leads to lower prices.
Yeah. But the one thing I will say, you talk about GDP growth, and for sure that's important. But another pillar of why China has grown so much is, as you talked about, people moving from the countryside into the city and the higher energy consumption associated with that. And that's still a lot of room for that transition. So although, you know, if you look at the United Nations, they predict population and things like that, there's a view that China is close to peak in terms of population and going to start slowly declining. But there's still 40% of people living in the countryside. And so there is a lot of expectation that demand will continue to grow in the Chinese economy because of that fundamental driver there of people still urbanizing, getting more energy.
You know, you've hit on such an important point, Jackie, and that is that people misconstrue where energy demand growth comes from. It's not so much from population growth. And you can see, we're going to post this chart, actually, the chart on energy demand growth versus population. If you look in China, as I said, it's almost a great economic study. Almost at constant population of about 1.3, 1.4 billion people, you have effectively a tripling of energy consumption in a very short period of time. That is the wealth creation effect. That is the migration from an agrarian rural economy into the urban wealth creating economy. And I can tell you, you know, I've done the numbers. The typical person in an agrarian economy in the world, say, you know, rural India, rural China, they may consume the equivalent of, it's really small, like 1 to 2 barrels of oil per person per year. But once you get into the urban center, you're talking minimum 25 to 30. So you've got almost a 10 to 20 times increase in energy consumption as a consequence of going from rural to urban settings.
Right. So if that transition, it continues, and it also does support economic growth, right? You get people more productive just by doing that. To put it in perspective where China sits on that continuum, today, if you look at the Japanese, the average person in Japan, a person in China uses about 60% of the energy as the Japanese. And the Japanese are pretty thrifty people.
Yeah.
So that's another reason why a lot of people say, hey, this energy demand growth could still move forward because they're not using much per person.
Right. And the question really is okay, I mean, we expect wealth creation to continue in a high population country like China, which means that energy growth is going to continue, albeit at a more efficient and moderate growth rate. But the real question is, what energy sources are they going to use and how are they going to power their economy?
That's right. And is oil going to be part of that? And so there's a real concern around the policies that the Chinese government has put in to push for more electric cars and transit buses. And I had visited China last summer, actually.
Yeah.
I wrote a blog about my trip. I
know you
all want to hear about my summer holiday, but I will post it to the show notes so you have that opportunity.
Well, post some of your pictures too.
Yeah, I had some photos up there as well. And I had some pictures from Shenzhen. Now, Shenzhen is a city that's a real leader when it comes to EV, partly because one of the biggest companies in the city is BYD, stands for Build Your Dreams.
Yeah.
And they're a big electric manufacturer.
Yeah.
They make buses and cars. And Shenzhen has now got half their taxis are electric. And the expectation is that they will all be that way in a few years. And I actually have a picture of the taxi line with all the green license plates, because in China, you put a green license plate on if you have an electric vehicle, whether it be a scooter, a bus, or a car. So it's really obvious and easy to pick them out. All the transit buses in Shenzhen are all electric. And this is one where I just didn't see it in Shenzhen. I saw it everywhere. Really, throughout my trip, I saw a lot of electric buses, and I do believe that technology is there to stay. I talk about it in the blog.
Oh yeah, no, it's there's no question that the combination of determined policy combined with the technology and the investment they're putting into battery electric technology, whether in buses or cars, is going to make an impact. It already is.
Yeah, so the big question is, what does that mean for the future of oil demand in China?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at some of the numbers, the recent numbers, I mean, if you look at electric vehicle market share of new vehicles sold in China, it is going up. And the latest data point was from December of 2019. Actually, 7% of all vehicles was classified as a new energy vehicle, 7% of all vehicles sold. But new energy vehicles, a combination of battery electric and hybrid electric, you know, the plug-in type.
Right.
But that's a bit deceiving. It's a bit deceiving because China has an interesting purchasing pattern for electric vehicles. It starts out very low in January and then ramps up into December. It has something to do with the way that their incentives are constructed. The average penetration over the course of the year is running around, I don't know, 3.5-4%.
It's 4.4% when you look at the annual average for 2018, which is the equivalent to 1.3 million new energy vehicles.
Right. And that's significant. Well, it's significant, but actually in the context of how many new vehicles they actually buy in a year and how many are still internal combustion engine, it's relatively insignificant. I mean, there's still a ton of internal combustion engine vehicles that sell. And as you know from previous podcasts, once you put one of those internal combustion engine vehicles on the road, it lingers around because it's so well built and has got a lifespan. So there's no question electrics are coming in, but the internal combustion engines still continue to be deployed on the road. So it's an interesting dynamic between the two.
Yeah. And so, yeah, 95% of the cars, this is the part we don't talk about, are still internal combustion engines. And can, like you say, they have 12-year plus life, depending on the scrappage rates. Okay. So the other thing I think when we think about oil demand that's worth noting is that not all sources of oil demand come from light-duty vehicles or from buses, for that matter.
Yeah.
So based on the IEA's 2019 estimate, gasoline accounts for about 23% of total oil demand in China. And so, you know, when we think about electric vehicles, this 5% share that they have now in terms of new car sales, that's not the fleet, by the way. The fleet is a much smaller number. And then on top of that, you know, it doesn't account for the use of oil for shipping and for long distance hauling and for petrochemicals and all those other uses for oil, which are still growing quite aggressively in China. For example, you know, when you talk about that 450,000 barrels a day of oil demand growth this year expected, 100,000 barrels a day, that is from LPG and ethane. Naphtha is, you know, 104,000 barrels a day, so which is mainly a petrochemical feedstock. So, you know, it's not just about cars. So it's important to keep that in mind.
It's not just about cars. You know, I think the conclusion on the car side is that there's no question there is a transformation occurring. But actually, if you look at total oil imports in China, it's rising still linearly, rapidly, and is tied to that wealth creation on the GDP side. I think it's important to note for our listeners that, okay, the number we were using is, say, 450,000 barrels a day per year incremental growth in China. If the economy slows down by 1%, we're talking about what is 80,000 barrels a day.
At the current intensity rate, that we'd lose about 80,000 barrels a day.
So if the Chinese economy is growing at what is it, 6%?
6.2 is what we expect this year. So if there was a 1% drop in the GDP and that would be the equivalent of about 80,000 barrels a day of demand growth.
Right.
So still a lot of oil demand growth coming from China, even in that scenario.
Right. So if that happened, we went from 6.2 to 5.2, then oil consumption would go from 450,000 barrels per day growth down to whatever, 450 minus 80, so 370.
That's right.
That's how it works.
Yeah. So, you know, it is important, but at the margin, as long as you're growing even 5%, then there's still a lot of demand growth there. And as we said, those pillars of the growth, you know, the urbanization trend, the fact that people still use not that much energy per person, the fact that not all oil demand comes from the light-duty vehicle fleet, do kind of support a view of, of continuing growth.
Yeah. So I think for our listeners, I mean, without getting into the data and the math and all that stuff, but we try and detect whether there are changes in the consumptive behavior of China. You know, in other words, is oil consumption getting more efficient? How impactful are the switching effects and so on? And I say, looking at the numbers, candidly, there was a big change sort of around 2008, 2009, in terms of when that phase of industrialization that I talked about earlier started to tilt into maturity. A hallmark of tilting into maturity is becoming more efficient with the way that you use your energy. I haven't seen, you know, much change to that relationship, or as I call it, the torque to the economy, the torque to the way people are buying, say, vehicles and so on. It's not consequential enough yet. You know, buses are interesting, but they're just really not that big a source of the consumption when you're talking about 1.4 billion vehicles, tens of millions of vehicles that are sold each year. So it's important to note that actually the more impactful thing to watch for China is actually the economy more at the moment than the substitution effects of alternative vehicles, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah, great point. And I'll just give you a number. The buses, including the long-distance haulers, which aren't being converted to electric, are about 4% of all China's oil demand. So not totally consequential to the bigger number.
Yeah, but you know, I don't think we're here to be flippant or dismissive of 4% because it's growing, right? But we're watching it. And at the moment, the rest of the economy still drowns out these effects. But there will come a day probably, you know, from the other work we've done, say 10, 15 years from now, it's going to be quite a bit different.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the next topic, which is the BP Energy Outlook just released a couple weeks ago. You know, this is an annual report. Lots of folks do these types of reports, whether it be the IEA or, you know, Shell and other oil companies. Equinor does one. But this is one we follow pretty much every year and try to look at what it looks at and what some key insights can be drawn from it. Now, one thing about this Energy Outlook is it has a lot of scenarios. I think there's like 7 or 8 different scenarios. So I'm just going to talk about a couple because it can get a little confusing. You know, I think the scenarios are great. It shows you there's so much uncertainty. You know, these are outlooks that go to like 2040. So yeah, there's a lot of different paths we could take, but it can be kind of confusing for people to absorb it all as well. Their base scenario is called the evolving transition scenario. And this is very similar to many other outlooks, like the IEA base outlook, where it basically says, you know, we know what policy probably is going to come, especially with the Paris Agreement. And so we basically make assumptions that seem realistic with policy that we expect and is quite doable.
So when you say base, I mean, like I hear that term a lot, and I've always, like, a base is what they think is the most likely scenario?
Yes, it's the most likely, although there's a lot of uncertainty. This is based on what we know today, where we think things are going.
So they've got all these scenarios. The base is the one they believe in the most, but they sort of try other ones just to see what happens.
That's right. Yeah, to see the sensitivities if you assume different things. And we'll talk about a couple of those sensitivities. They have one where they ban the light-duty vehicle for ICE, for internal combustion engines, and another one with this plastic one-time, one-use plastic.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the base. So basically, this is a scenario where electric vehicles reach 350 million by 2040, which is about 15% of the total fleet. And so this is sort of, you know, if you look at a lot of projections for electric vehicles where, you know, a lot of people sort of see as reasonable amount of ramp up. But in this case, oil demand continues to grow beyond 100 million barrels a day and a little bit higher than that and pretty much flat out to 2040. Other fuels also continue to grow, like gas increases 46%. Coal declines by only 7%. And renewables grow by 4 times, but they're still only about 17% of all energy. Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of path we're on if we don't see more changes to policy and technology.
Yeah. I have to say that, you know, you and I have worked a lot on developing these models of electric vehicles and penetration and the oil markets and so on. You know, I'm looking at this BP, the 15% of the fleet. By 2040, the number that BP is in their base case is 2 billion vehicles. And today in the world, there's 1.2 or something like that, 1.1, 1.2. Yeah. It's just a staggering number. I can't even fathom 1.2 billion vehicles. So it's growing to 2. Now, I have to say that there are many differing views on this. Like in our models, we're using like 1.8-ish. Some others are using sort of 1.6. Whatever it is, it's a lot. But I can tell you that depending on what number you use and what fraction, the 15% of 2 billion leads to quite a bit different outcomes if it's 15% of 1.6 billion vehicles versus 15% of 2 billion vehicles.
That's right. Yeah.
So, you know, all of which is to say is that BP and many others throw out these sort of scenarios and so on, but there's a lot of assumptions baked into these things.
There is. And the fleet size, you know, most forecasts were very consistent on fleet size. I had done some analysis 3 or 4 years ago where we would double the fleet size. So if you think about it, if we had 350 million cars in 2040 that were electric, we'd actually have more internal combustion engines than we do today.
Yeah, that's
because
ridiculous.
We still have, you know, the rest, the 85% is actually still more combustion vehicles than we have today. But now there's more doubt about that. And a lot of that is because there's a view that we're going to move to shared fleets, autonomous vehicles, and not everybody's going to buy and drive a car.
The people that say, no, it's only going to be, say, 1.5 or 1.6 vehicles because we're going to have ride sharing. Okay, fine. But it doesn't mean human beings aren't going to move around any less because as your energy consumption, wherever it comes from, electric or combustion engine, depends upon how much you move around, not how many vehicles are in the fleet.
Right.
So if you have less
travel.
Vehicles in the fleet, then your number of vehicle miles traveled goes up. And it doesn't really affect necessarily the total amount of energy you use wherever that energy comes from.
Yeah, but the argument there is that these vehicles that are going to put all the miles on are the electric vehicles. They're going to be the ones in the shared fleet. And so we're going to see, although the electric vehicles might be a smaller portion of the total fleet, they're going to get way more miles.
Right.
And so it's going to impact oil demand more quickly because, you know, it's going to be so convenient for you to jump in this autonomous vehicle that you'll just leave your car in the garage.
Yeah.
No, never use it.
I think that day is still technologically maybe not so far out, but I think there's a lot we've talked about it earlier on this podcast. Psychologically, we'll see how willing people are to let go of the driver and be fully autonomous and all those sorts of effects. But nevertheless, you know, we're sort of debating in places like China whether or the world as a whole, these numbers, it's still dominantly the result of this BP thing, an oil-fueled world. By 2040.
It is, under that sort of what we know today. But let's talk about their rapid transition scenario. And this
okay,
is where they wanted to get an extreme case, but a doable case, on measures to reduce fossil fuel demand. So they assume in this case that internal combustion engines become 55% more efficient by 2040. And this also affects cars, trucks, ships. Like, this is a big one. And we've done the modeling. If you assume that the combustion vehicles can use half as much oil, then you can make a big difference in terms of oil demand. This is a much bigger lever than electric.
It is. And I believe in that. I mean, the technology is moving rapidly. Electric, hybrid electric. I mean, it's coming. So we can't be naive to the improvements that we're going to see. You know, the only thing I'll say is that historically, every improvement in fuel economy has been offset by people wanting to buy bigger and bigger vehicles. And we're seeing that dramatically today. I mean, you get better economy. Oh, okay. Well, I'll just abuse that efficiency and buy a much heavier vehicle.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. In the absence of higher oil prices, it just kind of makes you want to, you know, have a bigger vehicle. Many people, even in China, by the way, when I went to China, people like the big vehicles there too.
But let's get back to the scenario. Yeah. Like, what do you see?
Okay. And there was more too. There was a ban on combustion engines in developed countries in China.
Mm-hmm.
So they were basically saying half of new cars are electric by 2040.
Half of new car sales.
Of new car sales.
Well, that's
so the
important.
Fleet.
Not half of the new fleet.
Yeah.
Half of new car sales. So the ban at the moment that is being proposed by countries like France, Norway, China, et cetera, is on the sale of new combustion engines.
That's right. And they didn't have a lot of information in terms of the fleet size or that with this particular scenario. Didn't have as many details. But they did talk about a smaller fleet due to shared autonomous. So they're trying to model that. They are also talking about biofuels, something that doesn't get talked about that much. But biofuels can grow. And they expect that about 20% of all road fuel in China and the developing world would be biofuels, so backing out, substituting the need for petroleum. They also get pretty extreme about the car scrappage rates, which doesn't sound like an important variable, but it really is.
It's huge.
Today, they said the average car life is 12 years, and they modeled 8 years. So that way, we get rid of those older combustion engines that are less efficient more quickly.
See, I don't buy into that at all. I think that the way vehicles, whatever type, are produced today is so reliable with robotic manufacturing that once you build it, it lingers. And if it doesn't stay in China or North America or other developed countries, it basically gets sold off into the used car market, into other underdeveloped countries of the world where they end up using it. It'll be an inexpensive purchase, but it still consumes
oil,
petroleum,
oil,
and so it's this is the state of the world. This is the competitive dynamics. Is that once you build and sell an internal combustion engine vehicle today, I mean, the scrappage rate, you know, the number of years before it gets sent to the scrapyard, is already 12 years plus. And I would argue it's going to 15 or more.
Right. And the trend has been increasing. The only thing that could change this is if there was policy put in place. But like you say, it would have to be put in place in the non-developed world. You know,
that
people
can.
And in places like Japan, you know, they have done that. They've said you have to get rid of your car at a certain year. But it is harder to see in countries that are not as wealthy, that type of policy actually taking hold. But remember, BP was trying to put together like a very, you know, I don't think a ban on the combustion engine is all that reasonable across such a big part of the world as well. But let's say it could all happen. What would that mean for oil demand? And so the answer from their work is they got oil demand down from about 100 million barrels a day today to 80 million barrels a day in 2040.
So a 20% reduction.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Those are pretty extreme measures that have been taken, and it's still so hard to slow down the growth of oil. They've slowed down the growth. They're declining, but to decline it, you know, it's still a lot of oil consumed in 2040, even if you assume all of those assumptions. And part of it is we tend to forget that 30% of oil demand is coming from light-duty vehicle cars and trucks. So even when you make all the changes that we just talked about, it doesn't affect 70% of oil demand.
Yeah.
And so that's part of it.
I would say, you know, if to put this in context in a historical sense, a 20% drop in 20 years. Okay, that's what 20, let's call it we're in 2020. This is 2040. 20 years, and you're talking about a 20% drop. In the scan of all the countries we've looked at, the only two countries that of meaningful size that have been able to do that historically are Germany and Japan, right? And that has taken a lot of social buy-in policy and so on. So it can be done. I'm not debating it can't be done. I think what we debate is that, do you think that's realistic for every single country in the world, right? To adopt those kind of stringent policies. And maybe we'll watch it, but I'm tending to believe that countries like Brazil, I don't know, big, heavy population countries, Nigeria, Pakistan, Bangladesh, et cetera, these sorts of countries are in a different mindset than to do that. I don't know. I mean, I could
be wrong. Yeah, and a lot of oil demand growth is coming from Africa. We have to remember that, right?
It's
not coming
countries,
from wealthy
sure.
countries. So, you know, I think you know, we had done some work. We had a global ban 2040 scenario that we did. We can post that as well as a link to the show notes. But I think, you know, we had said if you just did it on the electric car fleet, just with the electric car variable, you know, we would see 92 million barrels a day. They've done a much more, many more changes on top of that.
Yeah.
But it does show how hard it is to bend down that demand curve for oil.
Right.
You know, I want to talk about this plastic ban
let's do that.
So another scenario they looked at was banning single-use plastic. And you know, for those that haven't been following, there's been increasing discussion, especially in the last year, around using single-use plastics. And the concern is that a lot of this plastic is ending up in the ocean, and it's finding its way into birds and fish, like who consume it.
It's not a good news story.
Yeah, and it's hurting the animals, but also people eat the fish, and there's concerns about the plastic waste and what it does to human health as well. It's just part of the food chain. And so you've seen places like the UK actually put a ban on some single-use plastic. I don't know if you heard about the no straw
bans. Absolutely. So it was even showing up here, and I support it. I think that we do have to be mindful of these sorts of things, and I think we can expect that more countries are going to buy into this sort of thing, and it is going to affect a certain segment of oil consumption. But how big is that segment?
Yeah, and so no one had really kind of, I hadn't seen any work to look at that, right? So let's talk about that. I just wanted to put in Vancouver here, very close, has banned the straw. I don't know if you've had the pleasure of trying some of those paper straws out, but I will just tell you that I just prefer not to use a straw because it gets really soggy. So I think no straw might be the option.
My option.
And also Canada has been a leader in the G7. We did make a commitment in September of 2018 for the federal government to have a goal of using more recycled plastic, 75% by 2030. But so far, there hasn't been talk of a ban where the federal government would impose that on others, although we have seen some companies sign up to that voluntarily.
I think it's coming. I think we have to be realistic and, you know, frankly, even pragmatic about it. This is an issue. And so to think that it's not coming is, I think, naive in terms of the assumptions that we would make going forward.
Okay, so it is a concern when you think about plastic, because plastic is often stated as one of the strong pillars of the future of oil demand growth.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the IEA, they stated in October of 2018, this is the single largest driver of the future of oil demand. One third of all growth to 2030 and half of all growth to 2050 is going to come from plastics. And, you know, they talked about it as this is a pillar of growth that's very strong because it's not linked to CO2 combustion. When we use oil to create petrochemicals, of course, we don't combust it. So it doesn't create the CO2. So, you know, what is this going to mean in terms of oil demand growth?
But why don't you put it into some numbers in terms of oil demand growth?
Okay, so today, if you looked at plastics in general, there are about 15 million barrels a day of the 100 million barrels a day that we consume.
So 15%.
That's right. But they are expected, as I said, to keep growing rapidly. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that I didn't understand is how much of that demand is from single-use plastics that we're talking about. These are plastic bags, coffee stir steps, coffee cups,
straws,
right? So that's not all the uses of plastic, right, that
have. And there's many different types of plastics. I think there's like 6 or 7 chemical categorizations of plastics for different uses.
So the interesting thing is BP said that today, 3 million barrels a day of that plastic demand is coming from this single-use plastic area.
So 3% is single-use.
Well, it's 15 million of total demand from plastics.
Right.
And
yeah.
So 3 million of that is under threat from a plastic ban. And they had a view that this would grow to about 4 million barrels a day by the early 2020s. And so what they said is, okay, let's say in 2020, there is a global ban on single-use plastic across the world. And so they just ramped that down. So we go from the 4 million barrels a day that we might have had in 2020, considering the growth forecast, and then we just ramp that down. And so basically it means that in 2040, we have 4 million barrels a day less oil demand than we would have otherwise. And so oil demand is just slightly under 100 million barrels a day in their base case because, you know, they were expecting it to be a little bit over that, right? So it's not as consequential maybe to oil demand because it doesn't affect all of that petrochemical growth that's being projected.
Right. So plastics are about 4%, but the overwhelming segment of oil consumption out of the 100 million barrels a day is still moving people around.
And goods. Transportation.
Transportation. What is that? It's like 40% plus, actually 60 if you include
rail,
like, airplanes, ships, all that kind of stuff, right? So that's the segment we really have to watch.
That's right. The 4% is the single-use plastics. The petrochemicals does make a larger group for making other types of plastics
right,
as well.
Right.
So, but I mean, it is that is the part that is it's got the most growth. If you believe in the electric cars and technology in terms of efficiency, sort of flattening out oil demand, that the growth piece was really viewed to be coming more from plastics because we're going to get so much more efficient in our use of oil for transportation.
So let's put a wrap on sort of this number one and number two items that we're discussing here today, sort of the China. The conclusion is that it is changing. It is moving from an industrializing economy into more of a mature economy. Its GDP is slowing. That GDP, as its relationship to energy consumption growth, and particularly oil, is the thing to really watch. That is the most consequential. We have a substitution effect from electric vehicles that's starting to show, but it's really not that consequential yet. So in the near term being the next 5 years, it's really the economy to watch on the oil side. And from the BP, what are the conclusions we draw out of that, the different scenarios?
I mean, the scenario is we need a lot of changes to policy here if we want to bend down the demand for oil. And even then, even with some extreme measures, it's quite hard to do. So I do think it sort of validates that there'll still be a significant amount of oil demand in 2040 and in all types of scenarios. And then this plastic ban thing, it has consequences, but it doesn't necessarily change the overall trajectory here for oil demand that much either.
But something to watch, definitely.
That's right. Well, that covers it for the outlook for oil demand, both near-term and with China, and long-term when you think about to 2040. Thank you for joining our podcast today.
Thank you.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.